I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. There are challenges for any city, no matter how big or how small. Affordable housing, increasing diversity, and transparent government are just some of the issues towns across the metro face. Today, a conversation with a member of the City Council in Overland Park and a Raytown alderwoman. We'll hear how both towns are changing in diversity and what that means for the quality of life in their communities. Then, the story behind the civil rights case that moved President Harry Truman to action. We'll learn about the uniformed black World War II veteran who was attacked by police hours after being honorably discharged. What followed would set the stage for judicial rulings for decades. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Kansas City isn't the only city in the metro struggling with affordable housing. Overland Park is starting to wrestle with it. Meantime, Raytown is facing questions of financial mismanagement, and a state audit is underway. Now a conversation with a member of the City Council in Overland Park and a Raytown alderwoman as we continue our occasional conversations with area City Council members. With us, Dr. Faris Farisadi is a member of the Overland Park City Council. He represents Ward 5. Doctor, nice to have you. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Steve. It's a great pleasure to be here.
Bonye Mims is a Raytown alderwoman from her town's Ward 5. Bonye, nice to see you again. Welcome back.
It's an honor to sit here with you, Steve.
What's the hardest thing about your job, Bonye?
The hardest thing about my job at the present time is people getting to know me and trust me.
Okay. Is it taking some time?
Yes, it has. This is going into my second year, and being the first woman of color to ever be elected to Raytown City Council, it was kind of difficult for a little bit, and I won by 5 votes.
So how has that difficulty expressed itself or manifested itself?
It's had the good, the bad, the ugly. I think more so now, I think the people are learning how much that I do know about Raytown and have lived in Raytown and then coming from the state.
Okay. Dr. Farisadi, how about you? What's the hardest thing about your job?
I think the hardest thing is to absorb the information, the vast sea of information available to you, and understand the public opinion and try to have a balance between what is the reality on the ground and what is it that the people want to happen.
You know, people don't understand a lot of times just how demanding these jobs are. You have to do a lot of homework here, a lot of reading, as you mentioned.
That's true, because you are basically at the level of a local government, city government. You are acting almost as all three branches of government. You have executive powers, you have a quasi-judicial functionality, and then you enforce certain laws, basically.
You know, Doctor, you told one of our producers that affordable housing is becoming an issue in Overland Park in a way that's similar to what we've seen maybe in Kansas City on the Missouri side. Tell us about that. What are you experiencing in Overland Park?
So naturally, as Overland Park is going through basically a phase of maturity, it is not a very young city anymore, passing the 60 years mark, a level of problems like this eventually happen to all cities with that kind of history. And right now we are in a phase that we are studying the need for affordable housing. The city has intention to define it, because first we need to have a good definition of it. What is affordable housing? Where is needed? How much is needed? And there is inevitable that the city needs to implement the strategies to face this issue and don't let that bring down the quality of life that people deserve and expect in Overland Park. So I think it's a natural progression towards a more mature city that problems with affordability would raise, and the entities such as city, such as county, would react to it.
So you've actually launched a study in Overland Park to take a look at it, maybe as the first step here?
We are in the process of looking into this thing in a more systemic way.
Yeah.
I believe our neighboring cities such as KCMO are ahead of us in that. The bracket of affordability is defined. What is the formula to react to it? What jurisdiction the city would have in order to react to it is better defined. And I believe we in Overland Park and also in the county are in the initial phases of opening our eyes towards this need and moving towards programming for it.
Now, what's your gut tell you, Doctor? How big of an issue is it in Overland Park?
I believe it's not a tremendous issue at this time, but it doesn't, I'm not saying that it doesn't deserve attention immediately. And as a matter of fact, you just don't want a problem to blow in your face and then you will basically sprint to action. I think it's an upcoming issue. It's not in a critical red light situation right now that, you know, oh my God, we are panicking on it in any shape. But we are aware of it and we are planning to make this an opportunity to expand the city rather than a problem hitting us later.
It's not a cheap problem to address either, is it?
It's definitely not. The socioeconomic factors in Overland Park needs to be well characterized before we understand what is affordability. And the way we react to it should be in equilibrium with socioeconomics.
You know, Banye Mims from Raytown, is affordable housing a problem where you live?
Believe it or not, it has changed in the last 10 years. And keeping up with what has been going on, affordable housing, according to the market, yes, we do have it. And we have it's very diverse. And also, but looking at our affordable housing, which we've been trying to stay up on it, has changed a lot for us, where a lot of people may think that it's high, but it's very reasonable. But it's geared toward the 55 plus up more than it is the millennials.
So you're saying there's a need for more affordable housing for the older folks in Raytown?
Well, no, it's geared toward them. So
you already have it.
We have it. We
have
it. And our study has shown that we have it and that we're doing pretty good with it. It's for the millennials that want to move in and looking at the amenities that are around them. So, you know, like businesses and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So we've been pretty blessed with it. The 64133 zip code has really taken off and is booming. So we know which areas that it's doing a lot in it. So
why is that? Why is Raytown booming, at least in parts of town?
Basically because it's affordable and we don't have tax. You know, the taxes that we have are higher, but it's more like a lot of people are moving out of their houses and older and selling their houses and looking to rent. So we have a lot of senior citizens places also. Mm-hmm. So that's what we have.
Do you have former Kansas City, Missouri residents coming to live in Raytown because it's cheaper?
Yes. Yes. And also we do the same with our, believe it or not, we have more minority businesses that a lot of people don't know that we have because of it being affordable.
Hmm. Hey, how are those businesses doing? What's your overall sense?
Our businesses are doing well, and it's because we're limited. Also, as you know, 350, and then also with the businesses part, you know, there's no taxes on for them, and it's like the smaller ones because we can't expand on larger businesses because we don't have the land to build on.
When you say there's no taxes on them, what are you talking about?
Well,
there?
The tax that I'm talking about is earnings tax.
Ah, I see.
So, yes.
And that's something you have in Kansas City, Missouri that's been controversial at times that you don't have in Raytown.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And that makes a big difference.
Yes, it does. But we're getting more mom and pop businesses in, but yet it's still flourishing. It's slow, but it's moving.
People like mom and pop
businesses. Yes, they do.
There's something really appealing about that.
And we're having to learn how to stay and work within our means, too, because a lot of people think that we're all spending. But with the new administration that we have coming in, it's learning that we need to move more so into the 21st century. A lot of people don't want to do that, but we've made a lot of adjustments with a lot of the board members that we have right now. It's looking toward what can we do, because you have more going out, more expenditures than you have coming in, revenue coming in.
Dr. Farisati, again from Overland Park. Do you see many mom and pop businesses in Overland Park? Because when I think of Overland Park, I think of more chain retailers, that kind of thing.
Right. So I think traditionally Overland Park has attracted big businesses and even moderate-sized businesses, much more than a small business in terms of the, if you just did a survey and by numbers or by the amount of contribution to the local economy. But actually, one of the areas that I was interested when I was elected was to change this and propose Overland Park as a destination for small businesses. Mm-hmm. There are three essential elements there: financiers, landlords that could offer a space, and then the business owner. And I am thinking about the possibility of bringing these three pieces together with some level of facilitation from the city and county. So capacities and the potentials of the city of Overland Park would be better highlighted for these mom and pop businesses to move towards Overland Park because of the fact that they could be very successful there.
Yeah.
The socioeconomic factors exist to make small businesses grow.
I think of old Overland Park, your downtown area. Yes. You know, downtown Overland Park is different than downtown Kansas City.
That's right.
But that'd be a place where I would think of mom and pops perhaps flourishing in Overland Park.
Definitely. And also we have other shopping centers. We have other areas that amenities exist to to host this small business initiations. And I believe a new look at it and a way to connect these three pieces together in terms of financiers, in terms of people with ideas, would certainly benefit our city and in big spectrum our county and our metropolitan area.
I was going to say, you're saying that mom and pop businesses would actually enhance Overland Park, if I'm hearing
absolutely.
You right.
Absolutely.
Yeah. These are the
different arms that holds your economy. Mm-hmm. It's not all about big businesses. It's not all about small business. They
right.
all need to be there so you have a vast spectrum of tax base.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR, and we're talking today with representatives from Overland Park City Council, Dr. Faris Farisati and Banye Mims, who's a Raytown alderwoman from Ward 5 in Raytown. You know, Banye, how is Raytown changing in terms of diversity, which is a growing factor in so many Kansas City suburban areas? At least that's what we read in the Star. What are you seeing in Raytown?
What I'm seeing in Raytown is because of the affordable housing, we have very diverse. And when I look in my ward, for example, I'm looking at west of Raytown Road. And in my area, it is very, I see more people of color moving in, and I see those that are retirees that are coming in. And then, you know, we're not too far from Cerner. So that has helped change a lot into Raytown. But then also we're changing a lot in the administration also, and then changing in the way people look at things. So at the present time.
Changing the administration of the city itself, you're
yes.
saying a more diverse workforce there.
Yeah, mm-hmm. we just hired our first person of color as our city administrator. And so, you know, and we have our woman who is, which she's very sweet, but assistant administrator. So she's, you know, they're looking at the two of them and watching them work to bring these items together and also bringing people to the table.
How is a more diverse Raytown beneficial?
It's beneficial from my perspective is looking at how people need to know how to be inclusive. And mm-hmm. then instead of being more afraid of everybody that's coming in, now don't get me wrong, we got a ways to go and we have some issues and problems of our own to sort out. But being inclusive and bringing people in to make them feel comfortable and not afraid.
No, you have said that the police and the community might benefit from more training to handle a more diverse community. Why is that a priority for you? What's the need? Outline the need there for me.
The need from my perspective is making people not fear the police when they see them, to make them not fear the fact
that still happens in Raytown. As I guess it does a lot of places. Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. And you know, you have to get out there and you have to meet people. You have to. It's nice to sit and have coffee with a policeman, a coffee with a cop. But when you're in the community, it's a lot different and people will embrace you more. And those are things I've had to learn over the years, you know.
Yeah.
So I grew up in that era. And so, you know, when you're out and you're knocking on the doors and stuff now, people sometimes are afraid to even open their doors in the daytime where it used to be it was hard at night. So, yes, it's and then it's for people to be comfortable and not afraid just because you're judging me by the color of my skin, mm-hmm. not by my knowledge or my education.
Right.
And so some of that head came up for a little while, too.
So. Dr. Farisati, what are you seeing in Overland Park in terms of changing demographics there?
So definitely we are having a more diverse Overland Park. A five-year study by U.S. Census Bureau over the span of 2012 to 2016 shows a trend of enhancement in diversity. To give you some numbers, about 25% in African-American population, about 15% in Asian American, and in the neighborhood of 11% for Latino.
Say 25% African American in terms of
increase in the percentage in the population. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So all these trends are positive, and they are showing that Overland Park today is a much more diverse environment than it was even 5 years ago. And it continues on that trend moving forward. We are paying attention to those statistics, and I think we reflect. The city has to be a reflection of its people in terms of staffing, and departments of the city need to be aware of this, need to understand its value, need to understand this is actually a gift, and need to know how to harness this powerful wave coming through and how to be harmony with it and benefit from it.
How is Overland Park adjusting to a more diverse population? What are you seeing?
I believe we are having studies towards understanding it from the city planning point of view, mm-hmm. towards neighborhood preservation, towards its effects on our microeconomy, how businesses could prosper in the context of diversity. One of the good examples is just these small businesses that you were referring to that might have much more appeal for diverse background sector of the population. Or public safety operation is responding to it by inclusion our police officers mm-hmm. from different races. And also our judicial system and the others need to be aware of it. I also, Steve, wanted to put in that when we talk about diversity, the race portion of it is one piece, but we are also having cultural diversity, religious diversity, and even age distribution. And those are also parameters that in an academic look towards this could be considered. Mm-hmm. Because once your demographic changes, it's not only from a racial point of view, it's also from these other aspects that we need to pay attention to.
Yeah. Banye, you mentioned, I think you used the term building boom a little while ago in connection with Raytown. What are you seeing in terms of that in construction of new homes, new businesses? What are you seeing?
What we're seeing is not so much of the new homes, but it's the homes that are already available and that people that were moving out and folks that are moving in. From looking at, and I don't have any numbers in front of me, but for looking at the neighborhoods the way it has, we've had several different ethnicity groups that have moved in. So we've got Hispanic, we have Iranians, we have Indians, you know, we have Black, we have multiculturals and different languages. So in watching it change,
right.
It's basically in the community is changing, but you got to change the upper level too, so that they can be able to interact with the levels that are coming in and be able to react and not so much be a reactionary, but to be able to be inclusive and bring these folks together.
You know, I mentioned in the opening that there are questions about financial mismanagement in Raytown, that there are questions about a lack of accountability. During a 3-month stretch last year, city employees in Raytown inexplicably modified their timesheets tens of thousands of times. Last year, a $3 million budget cut decimated the police department. What's going on that front in Raytown?
Oh, boy, I knew you would hit that one.
Here we go.
Believe it or not, it was years of this budget need to be brought into compliance. Mm-hmm. And every time it came up to bring it up, it just brought a lot of tension, a lot of ill feelings. But you had a board that was, some of us were new coming in, and I'll just speak for myself, who had studied the budget prior to even being elected. Mm-hmm. And knowing that some of the changes, because there was more going out than coming in. You had 56 officers. Only 20 on the street at the time with an $8.4 million budget. And, you know, let the math explain itself, and you're only covering 9 to 10 square miles.
And there weren't enough officers given the amount of money being spent.
Yes. And you had the money, it was top heavy. And so you had to bring it into balance. You had people in all areas looking at you to make sure you brought it into balance, and we did. And it had a lot of things that went with it that wasn't, as most people would say, wasn't popular, but it was things that needed to be done.
So there's been a lot of tension over these issues.
Mm-hmm. It was. I think it's balancing out more now.
And a state audit is beginning. What do you hope that audit accomplishes in Raytown?
I would like to see the audit accomplish to tell you the good, the bad, the ugly, where your strengths are, your weaknesses are, you know, where you need to balance. And how you need to reflect, you know, from your city council, from your administrators, all the way down to your people, because those are your taxpayers, and they want it to be heard. And nobody at first wanted to really hear it. As I brought it to the table when I first walked in the door, was an audit needed to be done. So yeah, that took a quite beat in itself. And I thought if it came from us as the Board of Aldermen, it would be, you know, the people would see that we were being transparent. But in the same breath, that failed. So the people went out and they got their signatures and they got the audit.
Okay, we're going to leave our good conversation there. That was the voice of Bonet Mims, a Raytown alderwoman from the town's Ward 5. Thank you so much for your time. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Dr. Ferris Farisati was also here. He's a member of the Overland Park City Council from that town's Ward 5. Thank you for your time, too, Doctor.
Appreciate it. Thank you very much, Steve.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk about the tragic story of Sergeant Isaac Woodward, who was blinded just as he was discharged from the Army at the end of World War II. It was so tragic, it got the attention of the President of the United States. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Friday on the show, the Kansas City Public Schools superintendent talked about what lies ahead for the district that just received its highest score on state assessment tests. You can hear what he had to say at kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, meet the award-winning musician, composer, and producer who's touring the country to honor Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. with his We Shall Overcome tour. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, it's not often that a story from the pages of history grabs you in the gut and just refuses to let go. The story of Sergeant Isaac Woodard is one of those stories, and how couldn't it be? Woodard had just been discharged from his service in World War II when he got into an argument with his Greyhound bus driver, who was taking him home to South Carolina. A police chief in Batesburg, South Carolina, was summoned, and when Woodard failed to address the chief as sir, the policeman beat Woodard unconscious with a blackjack and drove the butt end into each of Woodard's eyes, blinding him permanently. It was a crime that shocked the nation and even its president at the time, that's Harry Truman. The story is told in a new book, Unexampled Courage, The Blinding of Sergeant Isaac Woodard and the Awakening of President Harry S. Truman and Judge J. Wattis Waring. Joining us now is its author of a new book, Richard Gergel, who is a U.S. District Court judge in South Carolina, who presides in the same courtroom in Charleston where the judge who oversaw the prosecution of Woodard's assailant once worked. Richard Gergel was a presiding judge in the trial of Dylan Roof, who was convicted of 33 federal charges relating to the Charleston church shooting. Judge, it's a pleasure to have you. Welcome to the show.
Oh, it's a privilege to be with you.
This is a stunning case. There's no other way to look at it here. How much attention did this case get at the time?
Well, it got a substantial amount of attention, but it tragically was not the only case of violence and even murder involving returning African-American veterans in World War II. There were a number of episodes in Georgia and Louisiana and in South Carolina that got President Truman's attention for reasons, as you just expressed, about the shock of a uniformed and battlefield-decorated soldier being beaten on the day of his discharge just grabbed Harry Truman in a way nothing else ever really did. And it became a source of first anger and then inspiration for President Truman as he launched what became really a landmark civil rights program that helped shape and change our country.
You know, this case is so moving that when you talk to Julian Bond about it, and he's the great civil rights leader, you know, he was still moved by the story 70 years after it happened. Tell us about your conversation with Julian Bond.
I had picked up on the internet a letter that Mr. Bond had written in which he described the blinding of Isaac Woodard as igniting the modern civil rights movement. I found that interesting. Obviously, I've been spending a lot of time on this subject, and I called him to ask him the basis of that statement. I didn't know him, but he was very generous with his time, and I shared with him some of the research I had been doing in which demonstrated the tie between the Woodard incident and actions by President Truman and Judge Waitis Waring, who was one of the first, really the first, of the great Southern civil rights judges, both of whom had been inspired by this incident. And I asked him, was that the basis of his statement that the Woodard incident had ignited the modern civil rights movement? And he explained to me, no, while those tend to confirm my statement, it was the impact it had on the African-American community. And he began to describe to me a picture he remembered from his childhood of the blinded soldier. The picture's in my book.
Yes.
And as he began describing it, he began to weep openly on the telephone. Mm. And he had to stop for a moment. And then he says, Judge, I apologize for my tears, but 70 years later, I still weep for that blinded soldier. Mm.
You know, when Sergeant Woodard lived until the 1990s, did he ever understand what he had helped ignite and what he had helped bring about in terms of igniting the civil rights movement?
He really did not. He did get a tremendous amount of notoriety in 1946. He went on a speaking tour. The NAACP sponsored a nationwide speaking tour in which he was a powerful voice for racial justice. And he knew that his speaking out had inspired a lot of people. He did not know, however, the effect it had on President Truman or on Judge Waring, both of whom started the process by which we identify today as the destroying of Jim Crow in America. So he unfortunately did not know about his impact on Judge Waring or President Truman.
How close did this incident come to destroying Sergeant Woodard?
Well, to beat someone and to blind them requires a tremendous amount of force. In fact, the police chief, Linwood Shaw, broke his blackjack beating Isaac Woodard. So he could have easily killed him.
Hmm. Unexampled Courage, an evening with Judge Richard Gergel, will take place Thursday evening at 6:30 at the Harry S. Truman Presidential Library and Museum out in Independence. You can RSVP to grab a seat at TrumanLibraryInstitute.org. Let's talk about the incident itself, Judge, and take us to the events of February 12, 1946, when Sergeant Woodard climbed into the Greyhound bus that would take him from Augusta, Georgia, to his home in Winnsboro, South Carolina. This was a bus that might have been a little on the rowdy side, given how many returning soldiers were on it.
Right. There was mostly returning veterans. These are young men who have served their country. And they literally had just been discharged from the military at Camp Gordon. So they climbed on the bus together, and it should have been a scene out of Norman Rockwell, right? I mean, these returning veterans. Isaac Woodard asked the bus driver at a stop, could he step off to use the restroom? And the white bus driver just took offense at that and cursed him and said to go back to his seat. And to his surprise, Sergeant Woodard responded by cursing him back and said, speak to me like I'm a man. I am a man just like you. Well, the bus driver said, well, you go ahead. And he went off the bus, briefly took care of his business, got back on. But at the next stop, the bus driver, now apparently no longer concerned about a schedule or anything else that he claimed later would be the reason that he would not honor his request. And he went looking for a police officer, and he found the police chief of Batesburg, South Carolina, a small town with a two-person police force.
Right.
And there he was taken off the bus, arrested, and as you said at the opening of the show, when he didn't answer yes, sir, to a question, he was beaten and blinded.
Yeah, tell me a little bit more about the police chief here, Linwood Shaw. Who was he?
He had been the police chief for about 8 years. He was about 40 years old. Unlike his two brothers who had served in World War II, he had stayed in the home front. And that raises the whole issue that we had 900,000 African-American soldiers coming home from World War II. They had fought for and some had died for American liberty. And they came home and they expected a better deal than the one they had, the world they had lived in. 75% of the soldiers were returning to the South, to the states of the old Confederacy. And what they were discovering, and it wasn't just Sergeant Woodard, that nothing had really changed in the home front, that the rigid life of Jim Crow was unchanged. And these African-American soldiers faced conflict in many communities because they would not acquiesce to the rigid segregation and the denial of the right to vote. And it became a source of conflict. And as we know from history, many of these veterans became the foot soldiers of the civil rights movement.
So let's take what happened to Sergeant Woodard sort of step by step here. He steps off the bus when he gets to Chief Linwood Scholl's town. Scholl at some point shows up. What happens at that point?
Well, Sergeant Woodard tries to explain himself that, you know, that he had simply was trying to use the restroom. And the response of the police chief was to pull out his blackjack and hit him over the head and to basically shut him up. And then he arrested him. And as he walked him towards the jail, which was about a block away, he had this exchange where he did not answer a question with a sir, just said yes, and that began the beating that ultimately led to his blinding.
Hmm. At what point did Sergeant Woodard begin to realize this blindness was going to be permanent? Because the days, the next few days for him are obviously just a nightmare.
Right. He wakes up the next morning. I mean, you can't imagine that he would not have had some type of serious head injury from being beaten like this. He drifted to sleep that night. He was thrown in the jail, drifted to sleep in a sort of semi-conscious haze. He woke up the next day, and he couldn't see. He just simply could not see. And that never changed. And he was advised, he was woken up and told, well, you're being taken to the town court to be tried for drunken disorderly conduct. And when he got to the jail, he had to be escorted from the jail to the town court, which was in the same building. And he tried to explain himself, but he wasn't allowed to explain himself. And he was convicted, just a very summary type of proceeding. And then he was told he had to pay a fine, which he did, and he was told he could go, but he couldn't see.
So he went back to jail, right?
He went back to the jail, asked to go back to the jail because he couldn't see. And he was the town doctor came in and examined him, saw he was very seriously injured, and told the police chief to take him over to the VA hospital in Columbia, 30 miles away, which the chief did. And for 2 months, he was over there at the VA hospital. And this story did not emerge immediately. This took a little while. Word sort of went to the president of the South Carolina NAACP, James Hinton, apparently from one of the orderlies at the VA hospital, that there was this blinded sergeant who had been beaten by a police officer. And eventually the story was delivered to the was shared with the NAACP in New York and to its national executive secretary, Walter White. And then it became getting a great deal of attention.
The sergeant's wife also wasn't too keen about having a blind husband. What was her reaction to all this?
Well, she just sort of let it be known that she didn't really look forward to having any continuing relationship with this blind husband. So here was this fellow who had been battlefield decorated. He was a sergeant. He'd won promotion. And here he is blinded. His wife wants nothing to do with him. And then there was an irony about the pension. Since he had been discharged from the Army just hours before, though he was still in uniform, had not yet arrived home, he was not given a military pension for he was given a partial pension for injury unrelated to military service, which was hardly it was not at subsistence level. So here he was, blinded, no real source of income, and his wife had abandoned him.
Chief Scholl, was put on trial in your courthouse, Judge, if I understand correctly.
Actually, in the courthouse in Columbia, but Judge Waring traveled. He presided in Charleston, but he came to Columbia to try the case.
I see. What happened during that trial? What was the result?
Well, it was a pretty awful situation. Civil rights trials were not common during this era, and that is really prompted, and I'm sure we'll have an opportunity to talk about President Truman's role in this, but President Truman was outraged by this and directed his attorney general to act, and within 3 days, criminal charges were brought against the police chief for the violation of the civil rights of Isaac Woodard. The government prosecutors were very ill-prepared. The defense lawyers were constantly invoking racial images and using racist statements. The jury was all white. It was a pretty horrible episode, hardly a picture of justice. And the jury acquitted Shull in 28 minutes. But what the unexpected consequence was, this was,
wow, yeah,
28 minutes deliberations. The judge presiding over it, J. Waitis Waring, who was a Charleston patrician. He came from – his father was a Confederate veteran. He had come from 8 generations of Charlestonians. Most of those prior to the Civil War were slaveholders. And he sits there and watches this trial, and he is horrified by the behavior. He keeps trying to call down the lawyers. He is horrified by the incompetence of the government prosecutors, who are clearly do not have their heart in this prosecution. And his wife happens to also be present at the trial. She had traveled from Charleston with him. And I say in the book that the trial forced both of them to stare into the Southern racial abyss, and it transformed both of them. Neither one had any real history of concern about racial justice. But they returned to Charleston, and there was no space in the white community of Charleston in that era to talk about race and justice. So they undertook their own private self-study, began reading important works on issues of race which were emerging in the post-war period, the most notable being Gunnar Myrdal's 1,400-page study called The American Dilemma. And they read these important texts together. In fact, his wife would read it out loud to him at night because he would come home from work tired from a day with his judicial duties. And over months of discussion and reflection and reading, they both went to a place that white Southerners rarely were in that era. He came to believe that the American Constitution and his duty and his oath of office as a federal judge required him to uphold the rule of law. And thereafter, he began issuing a series of landmark civil rights decisions, the most important being a dissent on a 3-judge panel case called Briggs versus Elliott, which is the first of the 5 cases that make up Brown versus Board of Education.
Wow.
And Judge Waring dissented. This is June of 1951. Filed a dissent in which he said that segregation as practiced in the state of South Carolina was an evil that must be eradicated. It must go and go now. And he declared segregation is per se inequality. It was the first challenge to Plessy versus Ferguson, the separate but equal doctrine that had been adopted 55 years earlier. He was the first federal judge, and frankly, up to the time of the Brown decision, the only federal judge that challenged the premise of separate but equal. And the United States Supreme Court on May 17, 1954, in Brown versus Board of Education, using Judge Waring's language and reasoning, declared government-mandated segregation of the public schools unconstitutional. Judge Waring, in many ways, was the father of Brown.
This is just an absolutely stunning story. I'm visiting this morning with the author of a new book who also happens to be a federal judge, Richard Gergel. The new book, Unexampled Courage, The Blinding of Sergeant Isaac Woodard and the Awakening of President Harry S. Truman and Judge J. Waitis Waring. If you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Again, 816-235-2888 or tweet us at KCU. you are up to date. And I should point out again that the judge will be in town on Thursday evening at the Harry S. Truman Presidential Library and Museum to talk about his new book at 6:30 Thursday. You can RSVP to grab a seat at TrumanLibraryInstitute.org. The judge, Wade S. Waring, was basically then sort of driven out of South Carolina, wasn't he, Judge?
Yeah, he retired. He was 71 years old, and he had been vilified and shunned in Charleston. No one would speak to him. White people would not speak to him. He had many African American friends, but he was and when he was ready to retire, he was ready to leave. And he and his wife moved to New York City, where he had many friends, and he became, in that newly adopted town, an icon of the civil rights movement. He was a very heroic figure. But, Mr. Kresge, let me talk a little bit about Harry Truman, your fellow Missourian.
Please.
Because he is also quite a shower of unexampled courage. When he learned of the blinding of Sergeant Woodard in a meeting with civil rights leaders, and he was immediately horrified, as all of us who hear this story.
Yes.
And he demanded then, this is something we must, we've got to do something. So the following day, he wrote a letter to his attorney general, and he, number one, made it very clear that time for federal action had arrived. And thus, in 3 business days later, the police chief was charged with criminal civil rights violations. Mm-hmm. But in addition, he said, it's time to establish a presidential committee on civil rights. It was the first presidential committee on civil rights. And within a year, that committee, which he went to the original meeting and told them, be bold, you know, let's not pull punches on this thing. His committee took him literally and issued a groundbreaking study called to secure these rights. And he it listed dozens of proposals to address America's serious racial problems, the most notable being the desegregation of the armed forces of the United States. Mm-hmm. Harry Truman embraced those in his State of the Union speech and a later message to Congress. And then, to the surprise of the Congress, he issued an executive order in the midst of his presidential reelection campaign. It was a very unpopular issue. He issued an executive order ending segregation in the armed forces. And then in his second term, fully implemented his executive order, creating the first really multiracial organization in the United States.
Yeah, and for a man from a man from the South, raised by parents who were deeply prejudiced, what a huge step it was for him to do this.
You know, he delivered this extraordinary speech to the NAACP in the summer of 1947, in which he really redefined the role of the national government as the protector of the constitutional rights of all citizens. And the day before he gave that speech, he wrote a letter to his sister, who resided with his mother. And as you mentioned, they came from southern Missouri. They were Confederate, the area Confederate sympathizers. And he said, I know mother will not like this, but I believe in what I say. And no one expected this, person from southern Missouri, the former haberdasher, the machine politician from the Pendergast machine, would play such a heroic role in the attack on Jim Crow in America. It was a remarkable story.
Well, what happened for Police Chief Linwood Shaw in the wake of his acquittal on charges connected with this case? How much attention, how much notoriety did he get? What did he ever say about this incident going forward?
I can't find he ever said a word, and everybody just acted like it didn't ever happen. So he went on to hold various public offices in his county of Lexington County, South Carolina, including service on the county council, elected positions, and he lived into his 90s. And in his obituary and in none of his campaigns is this ever mentioned. And when I began working on the book, I was seeking information from the town of Batesburg. It's now two towns, Batesburg, Leesville. I asked for information relating to the arrest and prosecution of Isaac Woodard, and no one in the town had ever heard of it. The town attorney, the mayor, no one had ever heard of the story.
That's just jaw-dropping. That is just amazing to me.
And let me, one day I went over about a year ago, and I walked the path Isaac Woodard
I was going to ask you that question.
Yeah, I walked the path from the bus where he was pulled off and initially hit, struck, around up the street and around the corner where he was beaten and blinded, and then to the town hall and jail where he was thrown that night. And with me was the mayor of Batesburg and the town attorney. And I described much of what I've said here today. They were horrified. And the mayor asked me, what can we do today to bring some justice to this situation? This is a little town. You know, a lot of little towns, they would like be in denial.
Right.
They wanted to do something. And among the things they have done is the town attorney went into town court and moved to set aside the conviction of Isaac Woodard and expunged his conviction.
Hmm.
And on Saturday, the town is erecting a historic marker in honor of Isaac Woodard.
Ah, just amazing. Let's go to some phone calls here. Max Skidmore is on the line here. Max, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. As an old white guy, I'm old enough to remember this incident. I was a young adolescent visiting in Kansas City. I lived in Springfield, grew up in Springfield, and I remember reading about it in the Kansas City Star and was horrified at the treatment of the sergeant. And in fact, it has influenced my own work through the years. I am on the faculty at UMKC. I'm a presidential studies scholar, and I've written several books and many articles on the presidency and so forth. And I just wanted to thank the judge for his work and to thank you for putting this on the air. It's a superb program. I learned a great deal.
Yeah, thanks, Max. I appreciate the phone call. And we just have about 45 seconds left, Judge. Tell me about the end of Sergeant Woodard's life. How did he spend his days, the last years of his life?
That's a great question. His family had moved to the Bronx. That's where he went. He eventually, with the help of the NAACP and various community groups, he bought a home, and he lived in that home with he had a partner and a child, and he adopted another child. His elderly parents lived with him. He ran a household as a blinded person. Hmm. He worked for a while running a newspaper stand. We've all seen blinded individuals do that.
Right.
And in the early 1960s, Congress changed the law that made him eligible for a full pension, which stabilized his financial situation. And he died in his 70s in 1992.
Yeah, that's right.
He owned his own home. He had lived I know his family. His family has helped me in putting together this story.
Right.
And they described him as someone who just made the decision he wasn't going to live with bitterness all his life, and he kind of put it behind him.
Wow. That's Judge Richard Gergel. His new book, Unexampled Courage, The Blinding of Sergeant Isaac Woodard and the Awakening of President Harry S. Truman and Judge J. Waitis Waring. Judge, thanks for a great conversation. Thanks for doing the book. We'll see you in town 6:30 Thursday evening at the Truman Library. Thanks for taking the time.
Thank you, Mr. Kraske.
You bet. Tuesday, one artist tribute to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Devin Davis, and Elizabeth Ruiz. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.